for the little people. I don't know where to begin. It's just, let me begin, because I am just as nervous as I gave my first talk. I want to thank everybody and the committee. I'm overwhelmed with it. This has been different. It's a different retreat, and I've been on a lot of retreats. But the love, and this is what it's all about here, is the love. And I had the opportunity to pick the place. I could have done Saturday night or whatever. And when I heard the end, and I know that this, to me, this is the best part, where we talk about the spiritual part of the program. And we talk about love and fellowship and recovery. And who the hell wants to talk about drunkologues, you know? I mean, let's get to the good stuff. We're going to talk about my journey. When I think, how do I look? Pretty good? I look good. There's only so much I got to work with. But, and Sissy, I couldn't find my jewelry. And when I can't find my jewelry, because I picked this dark, simple thing in there, and without the jewelry, it's just nothing. And Sissy said, it's only jewelry. And I said, but you know what? This is a story of a little lady, that a young girl who was a nobody. Nothing special, inadequate, inferior. And she became a somebody. And I had the privilege of having her, one of my mentors, was a man named Charlie Flint. And he was an alcoholic priest. I don't think you hear about his eminence. He's up there with Bill Wilson and the big me. But I owe everything I have, really. And he was one of the main, besides my wonderful sponsors. I know God put him in my life because he knew that I needed special direction. Because mine is one that I had such and when AA comes, they say, you can't have any justified reason. Well, I'll show you. You tell me I can't have something. And I kept that resentment for 3 years. And it took me 3 years to get my first step. Are there any relapsers here? Well, then, listen close. There are no, I hate that thing where they say, there are no stick with the winners. And I say, who is to judge who the winners are? And that's the truth. I still feel the same about that, because I think anybody who keeps coming back and sitting in one of these seats, there are no losers. We are all winners. But I remember, I was pretty much like Phyllis here. And she was the one that gave that little line that I'm sure about that bitch from New York. And I only use that special treatment for special bitches. We have to have a little bit of, you know, the compassion, sweetness, kindness. But sometimes we can smother you and kill you with too much love. And then it's time to interject. When you come back, when you come the first time, we love you until you're able to love yourself and all this wonderful. And that's what they did to me. They gave me love. And you know what? And with my arrogance and my ego and my self-centered fear, which I didn't know about, my inner, if you were nice to me and I sized you up, I just bled you dry with this understanding that you had for me. Because I had a husband like that. Until one day, he said, I don't give a goddamn if you drop dead, you ain't driving me crazy. And I said, what happened to this love and this understanding? And he told me that I wasn't, you know, that I was sick, not fit, and all of a sudden he changed this stuff. But after 3 years of in and out and in and out, you gotta change something. And the program answered, and they're frightened for us. So please understand that. If we get a little tough with you each time you come back, I mean, we can't. Obviously, you didn't get the message of love. So now we got to interject a little tough love in here. Yeah. Did you know you're going to die, bitch? it's just, you become fighting for them. And how? But I know that I got sober through prayer. And boy, when you don't pray. Don't mention the higher power. When I came through the doors and I expected results. I knew that I was an alcoholic. First time I walked into a meeting, I knew I was. There was no problem with admitting. I drank a quart of vodka a day. I mean, that's not social drinking. I did that. I did that, sir. I used to think that I was a social drinker. And every time somebody had a drink, I said, so shall I. Yeah. And I did that. The my road was, you know, I loved it. Somebody used a sentence or something about, I know I'm going to take it home. I'm going to find out how it goes because I steal all my stuff from other speakers. And then it makes me sound good someplace else. But someone said, because I always think of it during the Easter vacation, the Easter thing, was it's about the, let the crucifixion be over and let the resurrection begin. And that's what I, we prayed with Jerry prayed with me earlier, Betty prayed with me tonight, so I'm covered on all bases. And I felt the presence of God when the girls were singing that song. I got very emotional and tingly. I know he's here. I just feel sorry for anybody who's a little bit sensitive about this God crap, you know? Because I was you. I had a very strong, strong belief in God from the time I was a little girl. And I was a good girl. I did all the right things. And I was a good girl because I found out how to get notice and attention. I needed to be approved of. I needed to be told about. And I was the oldest daughter. And the mom's second, you know, her right arm, her helper. I was a good sister. I just grew up to be a martyr and a people pleaser. And I was groomed by my mother, and I didn't come from an alcoholic background. And I was groomed by my mom to be, and I wanted to grow up to be just like her. She had a sense of humor. I do look like her. I sound like her. I laugh like her. She gave me her sense of humor. And I had this father who was Italian. Now, do I look Italian? I had this father who was a good dad, but I didn't know him because he worked nights. And in those days, he worked weekends to make ends meet for his five kids. And so he didn't feel the relationships with his children, and especially his daughters. And the thing is, he didn't know how to talk to girls. He was an Italian, disciplined, strong. And one of the greatest compliments, Sissy, that I ever received, and it wasn't too long ago, when someone said, I said, oh, I'm nothing like my father. And someone says, I beg to differ with you, Margie. From what you told me about your father. You may look like your mother, but she said, you got your father's strength. And I thought about that. So I had a heavenly father and an earthly father. And sometimes earthly fathers and parents make mistakes. They did the best they could. They really did. And as we get sober, you realize they did the best they could. Because I'm a parent today, and my little girl was 8 years old by the time I got sober. She was 5 when I started my journey. And she was 8 by the time that I surrendered. And everything that she is, and she lives in Lawrenceville, Georgia, and I am so very proud of her. And she married a wonderful young man. And God has answered all of my prayers. Because then that happened in my third step. When I turned her and her life over to his care, and he's taken very good care of her. Because all I had to do today, I had to go about and do my father's work, and he took care of my business, whatever my needs were. But that wasn't as simple as that, because I don't know what, I only have one story and I'm stuck with it. And the people back home, and they're going to play this, they will say, oh, there, here she's going to tell that story again. But it's the only story I have. I wasn't a kid who partied and had, drugs. But this old lady was on drugs long before it was fashionable. A doctor gave me these, I was very tiny, 5'4", very petite, I didn't have I was voluptuous. I was small, not as small as my daughter, she's petite, but I had I looked all right. But what happened to me in every way, and being brought up by these wonderful parents with principles, morals, virtues, all the good and right things in life, to be a good human being, to grow up to be the Good Samaritan. I had the good teachings. And then along came Mr. Alcohol and drugs, and robbed me and cheated me and turned me into a liar, a thief, a cheat, someone that was hardly recognizable in my family. What's happened to her? And I became, there was Margie the nice person, and then Margie what I turned into, and then there's the person that I am today. And I used to think that all I had to do was go back and be that wonderful Margie who makes lemonade pies and takes care of people and does all this. And you kept saying I had to change. And I kept saying, they got help and nerves, and they don't even know me. Maybe they have to change. I was a nice, the only thing wrong with me is I drank too much. And boy, did I have a change. Because if I didn't, I would have drank. I wouldn't be here today. I still do all the things. I'm still a people pleaser. I still like to please people. But I have learned to take care and please me too. That was the most important thing. And already I can hear God say, I'm trying to say something, and I can feel the spirit within me pulling me to say other things. I can feel it, and I'm just going to let it flow, because I'm a little bit, I'm not there yet, and when I know I'm there, it'll take off, so hang in. And that's what it is, I'm feeling this point. I'm trying to tell my story, and I'm trying to do what I feel that he wants me to say. When I said that when I dressed up and I said that I look good, yeah, I always try to look my best, because I'm like honored and privileged to be standing up here in front of my peers, and I am speaking and carrying the message of my father and this program, and I gotta look good, because Charlie told me that I'm the daughter of a king and that I'm royalty now. I used to be a nobody and I became somebody. So I try to look like a king's kid. That's what the Jew is for. Royalty. Anyway. All I wanted to be was like my mom. And all I wanted to do was grow up and to have, not five kids, maybe three or four. And that I did. I married a nice guy, wonderful man, who learned to regret it. He was a very nice man. And when he, the fairy tale was supposed to begin, I had, by the time I was 21, I had a nice guy, and I had my first house in a little home in Crestwood, up in Westchester County, New York. And now I was going to build my little dream house. And I had a son, and his name was Kevin. And my next plan, what about God's plan? My plan. Next thing, I was going to have a little girl. I didn't drug. I didn't drink. I did smoke regular cigarettes. I was little Miss Squareville, you know what I mean? I grew up to be this housewife, and I was doing the perfect job. And then all of a sudden, when my daughter was born, Kathleen, that was the beginning of my, I believe, my disease. That was the beginning. Kathleen was born paralyzed from the waist down, and she was born spina bifida. And in those days, there wasn't too much you could do about it. And that was the beginning of my acceptance of things that I couldn't change. And having a very strong belief in God, and having a mother who was not religious, but very spiritual, saying to me, oh, wait, my young mom, God is good. God is good. Just, you know, you have a son. Be grateful. She was always saying to me, be grateful, Mark. You got to look at what you do have. Don't look at what you don't have. Look at your brother. His wife can't have any children. So she would turn this little alcoholic head, as I know it, who didn't drink yet, but I was an alcoholic then, because my emotions and my spirit, where the ism was already there. And she turned my head around to it. And as long as she was around, I was okay, because she would turn my head in the right direction. So I could see my mom as my first dependency. And I wasn't close to my father because I didn't see him that much. And I was a little afraid of him because you had to be good when daddy was around. Yeah. I never got spanked. I never got anything. He was always, but I just had that little, you know, I wanted to be so perfect for him. I also was brought up not to be a crybaby. Life is, you know, life is full of potholes. You just got to learn to get around. And Margie, you learned to plow right in. I just fell into the bottom. There you go. And at the beginning, it was okay. So I never, when I had my daughter, Kathleen, in my head, never talked about it. In those days, never grieved. Just learned to put on that big. New people were talking about me before I came in the room. I don't ever remember my mother having a conversation with me or talking to me about the baby. And she was to be always in the hospital until she died. I had made sure that I couldn't, made every effort to find out that I wouldn't bear another child like that, and became pregnant again. And I was carrying my second child. And Kathleen passed away in the month of January. And I remember feeling very secretly relieved. Because I remember when they come home, they were going to make arrangements. And I was going upstairs. See, they had stopped me from seeing her because spina bifida babies' heads enlarge and they change. And they moved her to a hospital in Long Island. And they wouldn't, parents' rights weren't there. And they stopped me from going to see her and all the family. It's best for you that you don't see her anymore. And I could call and inquire, but they wouldn't let me. And I could imagine with somebody picking her up, with somebody taking care of her, with somebody, whatever. But when she passed away, I was secretly relieved. And I prayed, and I used to pray, dear God, take her out of her misery. Because selfishly it would take me out of mine at the same time. But I was ashamed that I did this secretly. So when she passed away, and when they were making the arrangements, I was coming up the stairs, and I heard them say, "Well, we have to delay things, but don't tell Margie." Right? Don't tell me why. And I listened. And we have to make a larger coffin for this little white baby because we couldn't find, they didn't have one wide enough to fit her head. Well, I remember that's when I first learned to take deep breaths, swallow that lump, put on the mask. And when I was composed, I went in, made believe I never heard. And I would stare at the next day at the size of that thing, trying to visualize her in it. See, I deal with not drunk a lot. I drank over my feelings, my emotions, my fears, what was wrong with me. That was when my disease started to kick off. My attitude, then Mom would say, "Marge, be grateful. At least you have a son." She would be able to turn my head around again. And I did. So I swore I was never going to have another baby. That was it. I was going to be grateful, like Mom said, and just get on with it. And I sold that little house, bought a bigger house, moved my mother and father upstairs, and my brothers, had an uncle on the third floor in a studio apartment, and I was hell-bent to mother somebody, and I took care of her. And this went on. And then my son grew up, and he grew up to be quite an athlete. And from the time he was little, he was kind of, they were grooming him to play Major League ball. He was that good. And I would go to the games, and I wanted him to play the outfield. He played on the mound, the pitcher, and I was always afraid that he was going to get hit. Because that was my secret fear, that he was going to be hit by the ball, and when is the next one going to go? But I never said that out loud. It was just one of my many secrets. And when he was a senior, I learned to where my addiction started. When I was when Kevin was in the Little League World Series thing there. And I'm getting very nervous now because he's always pitching. This was cute at the beginning. It wasn't cute anymore. These kids get really, in Little League, when you get to that stage, Little League World Series, you got to be good. And there he was, that target in the middle. We're going to hit him in the head with the ball or in the groin. And I could never watch. And that's where someone said, "My God, you're so nervous." And then I went to the doctors because they was run down from going around taking care of everybody. And I was getting dinner and dinner, and I went to the doctors. And what did he give me? An amphetamine. I loved him. I mean, if I was a good worker before, you should have seen my head. I vacuumed, I swear, the garage, the cellar, the attic. I had, and there were men across, the husbands in bed,
Al's wife, I mean, she, look at, what a good worker I was. I was helping in the eyes of, yeah. I knew all the cops and all the shifts because I was outside planting tulips at 2 o'clock in the morning. But you see, they made me very nervous. And this personality, this nice, easy, you know, margin, I suddenly started to change. I was very angry and very hyper. And somebody said, my God, why don't you relax more? Have a drink. And I don't know. But, and I was great for Pepsi-Cola. And, well, what I learned, and on the edge of every little ball field that you go to out of town when you start traveling all over watching your kid play ball, and when he's in an all-star play, you're going to this town and that town, he played in Philadelphia, he played here, he played all over, and I was following him. But I learned to become a spectator, and I learned eventually to see that curve when I finally opened my eyes, is because somebody said, give her a drink, and they gave me a whiskey salad. And I guarantee, within a month, I had everybody needs a blender now. Bought a blender, and I was always making these things in case somebody came in around dinner time, you know, they'd be ready. But you know, I didn't think that, because I was way behind. Everybody was doing this for a long time, drinking cocktails. And so I guess, well, sort of, I was catching up. But I didn't drink, I knew that was all. I was now alcoholic from the first drink, because when I had that drink and I went down, did you ever see the thing with Archie Bunker, when he was in the cellar there, when he drank the thing and it went down, and then he went, and something exploded in here, and I sensed a feeling that I never experienced in my life, and as I know and understand it today, it removed my fear. And we live by self-centered fear, and from that time on, I found the nectar from that. I thought it was a gift from God. All I had to do is take that pill. When you're spiritually dying, as I understand it, your spirit is low, you're depressed, you want to hide under the covers, and you're down. And when you're spiritually awake, you're up, and you're... Well, this... I was dying spiritually, and my life and what was happening to it, and I was trying to grin and bear it and be Papa Daddy's daughter, and not be a crybaby, and accept life on life's terms, and get through these potholes. But it was like a window shade, not a blind window. And my life was like slowly, the light that was there one time slowly started to get darker, and the light was gone. And those were the fears that were setting in. And I was sensing something was wrong, and I couldn't quite figure out what the heck it was. All I know is that there I go. I'm off again. I said that day. Sometimes I forget what the heck I'm going to say. And the bug is in Georgia. I'm thanking God and praising God. And I'm walking around, stepping on and there's this bit. And there's one here. Sorry, me. He's after me. My sister would love it. At least there might be. Anyway, I'm watching, I'm using alcohol before. Now, if your kid is a good pitcher, you only can pitch twice a week, so I would only I was really only drinking like twice a week, and I learned that to use alcohol when I was afraid, all I had to do was to just have a drink before I had to do something, and I could do it, and it took away. So I learned to use alcohol as an escape. And I became very functional. I became the president of the ladies' auxiliary in the fire department, and I became the president of the Little League Mothers Club, and I was running around, and I was very functional and just a wonderful person. I had found the combination of life. To kill the fly, she uses it. And I found the combination to, it was perfect. And for a while there, I was happy, and I was having fun, and I was enjoying life and everything. And then my traveling all over watching play. And then all of a sudden, reality set in again. And Mom was very tired, and I was 37, and I was having heartburn. And I thought, well, geez, I am 37 and I'm getting old. Maybe I should go for a checkup. And I went for a checkup, and he told me I was 5 months pregnant. I knew, that was God's way of taking care of something that I couldn't do. If I ever knew I was carrying a child, I think I would have lost it. So I had the shortest pregnancy in history, 4 months. And I thought I had gas, and this baby was moving, and I put no weight on. I never throw up anyway, so I had no idea. And I gave birth to a little girl. After 16 years, I had Kelly, who lives in Georgia. And just everything's great. My son was her godfather, and he was getting ready to for planning his future in college career, and they were talking contracts and money. And so Kelly was 10 months old, and Kevin had just came back from one of the workouts. They send you away for 2 weeks. And when he came back, I remember when he was telling me all about it, and he said, and I'm going to be rich, and we're going to have everything, and I got it. And if I just get this money, and I won't, I don't have, even if I hurt my arm on this money, this contract, this is mine. And he said, but in the meantime, he said, I didn't have suffering. You got $3? That's what happened to all that money, is just that. He said, well, I'll pay you back when I get rich, man. And there was no happier, handsome kid in the whole world. His all his dreams were coming true. And he went out that door. And that was the last time I saw my son. Because he was killed in an accident that night. So once again, I just sort of leave it there. Once again, what I wanted to say. So to talk about my drug log and how I abused my drug, I mean, it went like a grass fire after that. There was nothing. That was in August. And I still swallow that one. But, you know, these are facts of my life today. And these were things. And that's why I say to you here, sometimes we struggle with this higher power thing, God as we understand Him. And at that time, I was drinking and I was drugging. And my attitudes went, my spirit was shot. That shade was coming down. I was in darkness. And I went to his funeral. Now, I didn't, little white cross was one thing, but a 6 foot big one. And I couldn't believe, I was in shock. I mean, no reaction. I did not scream, holler, carry on. I just did what I do best. I knew everybody. This boy was the whole town. It was on radio. He had the biggest funeral. He was a small town celebrity. It touched everybody. And he was the only grandchild for 9 years. It just touched everything. And I couldn't believe that God would do this to one woman. And I couldn't believe why I kept thinking, what the hell was I born for? trying to figure. And then suddenly, when I came home from the funeral, the wake, and I went into my daughter, and as all mothers do, we go in, see our babies, cover them up, check them. And I knelt on the floor beside her, you know, when the bar is there, and I had my hand, and her little rear end was sticking up there, and I patted her and was rubbing her. And I remembered saying, "Okay, God, you took my Kathleen. I don't know if I told you, the baby that I was carrying, did I mention that? The baby was born dead. Kathleen died in January, and my next baby was born dead before its time, and they had to take it from me, March 10th. So that was the two of them within 3 months. And that was when I said I would never have another baby. I just said, I can't hurt anymore. And I just said, that's it, I'll accept that. But when this came, it was so hard for me when I came in these rooms. And when I threw out the Serenity Prayer, I almost threw up. But the thing of me closing the door on God was the night that my son, when I come home from his funeral and I walked in and I patted her on the hiney and I had my last talk with God for 8 years. That's okay. I have to accept the things I can't change. And I didn't even know this running prayer. There's nothing you can do but it. Deal with it. But I said, you took the girl, and now you took my son. Whatever did I do? And then I found it, what I did. See, what I did and why he took. For the first time, I looked at my God, my loving God, turned into, because of alcohol and drugs in my system. The darkness within me. No light. I found the reason why my son had it. It was because what kind of a mother would pray carrying the baby for her baby to die? I'm being punished. I never should have prayed for Kathleen to die. That was my secret. That was why. That was why. All right. I did not stop believing in God. I just was afraid of his will. And I just closed the door on him. And I said, you took all the rest. But this one is mine. You keep your hands off her. She's mine. And that's it. I closed the door. And I heard a lady in sobriety that I will never forget. And she helped me in my first, to help me to understand the more of a meaningful concept of my third step. And she said, my God is a gentleman. He's not only a gentle person, but he's a gentleman. And gentlemen have good grooming. And they never go where they're not invited. So I make sure, knowing that he's such a gentleman, that I invite him into my day, each day, to make sure that he feels welcome. And I never forgot that. And you, I hope you can take that home with you. Because he is a gentleman. He never takes away our will. He just says, all right, you don't want me, you don't need me today, do it your way. And I make sure I invite him. So you always hear someone who will touch you and take you, you know. There, you never know when the message is going to come from. So I got on with my life, and whatever. But from that time on, my disease went like grass fire. And it didn't take me, 3 years? I was drinking a quart a day, popping my pills, sold the big house. Couldn't live with him anymore. See, his family had a curse on it. Nightmare. And I started to think, his mother died when he was young, his brother died, this one died. There's a curse on his family. And I married. And he was such a good man. He did everything he could to try and you know, it was my journey. There was no way of stopping it. And by the time that I separated, sold the house was full of hard luck, bad luck, and I sold it, and he moved into this nice little apartment, and it was there. Now he ain't gonna make me drink anymore. And I drank myself right into my little rehab, which was available, and that was the local Grasslands Hospital in the psychiatric ward. Up in the flight deck, as they call it. I was contemplating suicide. Now the pills aren't working. I mean, nothing's working anymore. I'm drinking and I got that much in it and it's not doing what I told it to do. Now it's telling me what I do. It told me what clothes I could wear because I didn't do the laundry. It told me who I could hang out with. It just took over and controlled my whole life. And I couldn't believe. I had my family. I thought they abandoned me. I just felt so alone. But I had my pride. And I had my, you know, I'm a fighter and I'm not going to. So I sat there drinking and I'm watching, and I said, what I got to do, everything's over, I can't go on anymore, I'm just going to, well, the kids are dead. Oh, I didn't tell you. The year after my son died, the telephone rang, and it was the emergency room down the hospital. Mrs. Freer, we have your husband down here. We don't know if he has sunstroke or please come down. I didn't even rush. That's how negative I was. I knew he'd be dead. He had a heart attack. Everybody in his family has a heart attack. He's going to die. I went out in the kitchen and made a drink. And I made a good sip drink and got somebody to rush go and went down to the hospital. He didn't die. He lived. He had a massive heart attack. But I lived for the next time, worrying about sleeping with him, when he came home, touching him, and he would stop his breathing in the night, and I would be afraid to touch him, that he would be dead. I had to get up in the middle of the night and have a drink to get back in his bed, that this man is going to drop dead on me. I lived in the world. When you talk about fear, I lived in the world of impending doom. I didn't know who is going to go today, because I knew that my life was jinxed. I either had an Italian malarkey on me, or an Irish curse from inside. I don't know, but I knew that I lived in darkness. And when I sat there this time and I said, I can't go on anymore. I can't stop taking the pills. I can't bring this kid up. She was beautiful. So sweet. I can't bring her up like Kevin. How am I going to make those Girl Scout cookies and brownies? And how am I going to do it? I couldn't just about, you know. And that day, the reason I was thinking that is because I had my first blackout. And I'm sitting there in the chair and I'm looking at this television and what the hell's that show doing on? It's only 5 o'clock. And the last time I remembered was brushing her hair and getting her ready for preschool or kindergarten. And all of a sudden it dawns on me. Kelly, I started calling. Where is she? Stage where I would jeopardize something about her, then I would do something about this drink. And then I thought, well, I know what I could do. I have no one to leave her with. I have nothing. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know about alcohol, AA. It didn't occur to me. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down to so-and-so's house. She has sleeping pills, and I'm going to crush them. No, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to commit suicide. This kid would be better off. I can't leave her. He's half dead. Who am I going to leave her to? And the head starts going, and I said, I'll crush the sleeping pills. I will put them in her orange juice. She trusts me. She would drink it. I would hold her under the water, put her little Carter's nightgown on, powder her, tuck her in bed. I would kill myself. We would go together. He would come home, find us. He came down. He would find us. The shock would be so terrifying. He would drop dead. And we'd all live happily ever after with all our kids in heaven. Let me tell you, that was real. That was the realest thing that ever was. And the only thing that saved me from doing it was that I was so negative that I said, with my luck, she'll be dead and I'll wake up. And that's the only reason I was there. So my negativity saved me. And then I said, I am losing my mind. I belong in a nut house. So when I call my doctor, he says, Margie, where are you getting these pills? Forget it. And I went over the next day, and I asked the lady with 13 children. She knew that I was drinking. I said, Laura, I'm so much in trouble. I don't know what to do, and I have to go. I'm going over to Grassland. I'm going to turn myself in, and I got to sign myself into a nut house. But you see, I'm not all nuts. I knew I wasn't going to let him send me in, sign me in, because he could keep me in there. I signed myself, and I said, and then with their permission, I can come out. And that's what I did. And I was there for 3 months, and I never did take another drug again. And when I went to the rooms of AA, I took all the steps the first night I left. And made a decision that I didn't need them. So my problem was not, I came with all my problems, and no one had a more heartbreaking story than me. And they were sitting there, oh my God, jeez, I don't know if I'd stop drinking in my other life either. What are we going to say to her? They could understand why I was so angry at God. And yet they knew that the only way for me out was Him. So I believe that there was enough people that understood and prayed for me, that prayed me back. And the only thing that I did right in 3 years is that I kept coming back. And that little skinny thing that took amphetamines and stopped taking them, within, I had, by the time then, I had such a hole in me of emptiness. And if you don't replace that, when you take away the drugs and the alcohol, and if you don't replace it with the tools, the program, you don't have a chance. You can only stay dry so long, and then you'll drink again. And I didn't change, and nothing changed. I just stopped drinking, and I wouldn't drink for 7 months. And I met this guy, Jack Brennan, who passed away at about 46 years or something. And he met me at a meeting, and he said, Margie, what am I going to do with you? I had a slip. You never had a slip. What do you mean? I had 7 months, 8 months. I had 5 months. I said, what did I have? He said, you weren't finished drinking yet. You, he said, in order to have a slip, you got to have a grip on something. What'd you have a slip? What'd you have a grip on? At first step, you don't even know what the meaning of it is. He said, you just stopped drinking. You were on the way again. And when they would say people, places, and things, you know, hanging out with people who want sobriety, you got something, you see they got something, go with them. They don't have nothing I want. They had God. They're going to turn me into this, and you got to change. And I would,
into what? A robot? You know, my arrogance and my ego almost, but I know that I would feel that when Christ was crucified, I had to go through every humiliating, everything that I could possibly go through to strip me to become willing to do anything you ask me. And I wanted to bring up my daughter. And I knew that I couldn't kill myself. And I knew, he's going to die soon. Whatever, because he was a walking time bomb. And I just got to get my act out. I got to do something. Yeah? So I went back to the room, and for the first time, maybe this will help you to understand the simplicity of some little stories like. And you know, if you can't, you know, with the people, places, and things, and you relapse, please keep coming back. Please keep coming. Don't let your pride bury you, because you're not going to die from drinking. If you don't come back in these rooms, your pride has killed you. She died here with her pride. Because this is where it is. When I come back through that door, when I surrender, that's why I say, did I look nice? I wore a 24 and a half dress. I was 220 pounds of just pure, solid anger. Hard as a rock. If you smacked me in the face, you couldn't make me cry. I learned to harden my heart so that I could never be hurting. I couldn't cry. And every time, and I went to a summit, what's this pain in my chest? There must be a tumor there. And he'd say, those are tears you've never shed. What the hell is crying going to do about it? You know, give me money to take care of my daughter in the hospital that's crying for who's going to pay this bill. Give me money to pay for these funeral bills. Yeah. And you don't anticipate on buying cemetery plots and funeral things when you're a kid. Yeah? I was so angry at society and fed up with Catholic charity. All they wanted to do was find me a psychiatrist. I needed money to bury these kids. And I would harden my heart. And I get angry at everybody. And that's the way it went. And when I finally surrendered, and I come back in 1974, I see this lady sitting over there. She was always there with her afghan. And I said, Jesus, I'm going to have to make an afghan. I think of that when I see afghan. I never did. But you know, she led me into this program, and then I met Charlie. She kept saying, you're never going to make me grateful. I'm telling you right now, Marie, you might get me, I'm not going to get you sober, she said. And I don't care if you're ever grateful. Just shut up and get in the car. And that's what I did. And everything I said to her, she got me at another turn. She had an answer for it. And I come home. Oh, by the way, when I come out of the hospital, I went back with my husband. I realized in there that it wasn't him that would drive me to drink. I needed that time alone. So, you know, when somebody says, leave me alone, alcohol, the best thing you could do to if there's any alcohol behind, is to leave them alone. Just let them drink themselves right into oblivion. I mean, don't stop them. You're stopping the progress. And that's the way it went. And when I got there, when I come home and I say, you say, how's the meeting? I say, that bitch is going to drive me to a drink, but her higher power. She knew not to say God, to HP or higher. So finally, I made AA. my second step, I made AA my higher power. I can do that. I know today that he speaks to me through people in his room. That's what I did. And I was about 3.5 to 4 months over. And when the magic, as Marcia said, the magic, the miracle happened. And by now, for the first time, I had gone to 127 meetings in 90 days for the first time. And I went to third step meetings, so they were coming. You know, she dragged me up to every, and she knew. But there, in 1971, she gave me, a great crime book. And in there was a story about taking your third step. Somebody was always trying to... All right, I'll read it. And here is a cynic and a pessimist reading a beautiful prayer. And the prayer said, "Thank you, God." Now the cynic is reading it, and I'm answering it. "Thank you, God." There. I almost threw up with that one too. "Thank you, God, for all that you've given me. Oh, gee, a lifetime of heartache. Thank you for what you've taken away. Every kid you ever gave me, you took back. And you gave me a half-dead husband, and you gave me this, and thank you for what you've left me. Now I'm too drunk to raise this kid that you gave me late in life." And I threw the book. And it was amazing. It was amazing. Amazing grace. That at the end of it, and I'm cleaning one day, and the book was put on the shelf, I guess. Somebody picked it up. And I opened it up, and I looked at this book. And I'm opening it. And I said, "Oh my God, 1971. And I sat, and I remembered the story. And there it was. And I used to think now this is like 3 years later, you have the rights to write, and the steps are in mind. I used to think that, now I want to tell you something else before that. How I took my third step. Because that was the resurrection. That was the opening. That was the door that I had slammed shut 8 years before. And the doorknob was on my side. And I wouldn't. I can't. And when I hear somebody say, "I can't." No, "I can't" means I won't, I'm not going to, and I will not. If you take off the apostrophe and the NT, and you got, "I can't." I can't. I'm not going, I'm not going to forget it. Okay. She told me, she always waited till she was going home, and then she slipped me this little wedding little comment that would give me a resentment for the night. And she said, "I got to talk to you." She said, "You're going to drink again." I said, "What?" "You're going to drink again." I said, "What do you want from me? I'm going to, you know, where's her appreciation? I'm doing everything you tell me to do. I'm going to meetings. I'm going to step meetings. I'm doing this." She said, "I know, Margie. I know you are." But she said, "It's time for you to take your third step, and you stay on." And she said, "You can't do in cafeteria stuff." And she said, "I'm not saying you're going to drink tomorrow or this week. I'm just saying you're going to drink again." Because she said, "You made me your higher power. And you made the group your higher power. And someday there's not going to be a meeting. And someday nobody's going to be around. And you got to have your own power, your own switch. And what are you going to do? You're going to do the only thing that our world knows what to do. You're going to become overwhelmed and frightened, and you're going to do what we do. You're going to go out and buy a bottle or get a drink." I went in that house. I was so mad at her. And I went into the baby, the baby's 8 years old, and the blinds were open, and the moon was shining through. And I covered her up, and she moved. She is the cutest thing.
and I saw an angel wing. And the moment of honesty hit, and I knew what Marie went. I had heard about letting go and letting God. I had heard about, yes, I do have a right to be angry. Yes, I do. That I was, it was cruel what life did to me. Yes, I had the right to feel that. Yes, I had sadness in my life. Yes, there was tragedy. Yes, it was unfair. But those were facts. Now deal with it, Margie. What are you going to do with it? And I, that honesty came over me and something was happening. And I said, okay. I remember saying, okay, I just went, okay. I was angry, okay, you win. And I hate to give up. You win. And I realized when I looked at her and touched her, that for the first time, the honesty that came over me is that if I never took another drink and stayed just like I was, cynical, pessimistic, not trusting God, not believing in the good things, I knew that I was an unfit mother. And I always prided, no matter what, I was always a good mother. And I had that moment of honesty when I knew that I was, I'm not fit to bring up this kid. And when I'm not healthy enough to bring up. What am I going to teach her? How to hate? How to not trust? Not believe? What am I going to give this little kid? And then I was overwhelmed with fear, and I was overwhelmed with love. For the first time in my life, I said, I love her more than anything. But for the first time, I knew what love meant. Love is letting go and expecting nothing in return. I said, is that what you want from me? And I said, take her up with the rest of the kids right now. And I meant it. And I said, because I kept saying, don't you dare die. Don't you let them die. Don't you let him die. And I would be left alone with nothing and no one to love. And I said, is that what you want? I said, take her. I want to stop drinking. I don't want to. I want to start. See, I got two birthdays. The day I was born, March the 22nd. And the day I started to live was that night. When I said, take everything I got, take my left, all I got left, and take him too, because I'm killing him by degree. And leave me nothing in this world to love. Is that what you want? I'll do anything, but God grant me acceptance of your will, because, I put my hands up like that. And when I put my hands up like that, I had a blood transfusion that tingled down my body and went from my head down to my toes. And I tingled, and I always tingle when I'm telling it. And chills went up and down my back, and I said, oh my God, he's taking the wrong one. I thought I was elevated. I mean, I knew because of things, but when it got over my chest, something exploded in my chest, and it was the opening up of my heart. It was the healing. It was the healing of my heart. It was, he melted me. He just melted me right down. And I felt like, my God, I felt like the little, and I was so fat. 220, I felt like the little doughboy, you know. And that, I felt sore. And I was crying. So I went on crying and crying and crying for the next 2 weeks, because I hadn't cried in 8 years. All I know is, that's my story. That's the whole thing in a nutshell. And I know there are people here that have got the door closed. One day in my writing, and I'm not a writer, but I was thinking about my life. And this is the secret. And I wrote, you're as only sick is your deepest secret. And by the way, I couldn't ride
on that beautiful spiritual experience to keep me sober. I had to go on to the fourth step and the fifth step and share the pain and the shame and the guilt and the anger and all the stuff that I needed to share with my sponsor. And that was the next healing. And it was a continuous one, on and on, until I received my holy on. And it says, I wrote, you're only as sick as your deepest secret, and having the horrors heard helped to heal my hurt. But most of us are homesick for the home we never had, and sick from the one we did have. But what I got from that is, I realized what I was like walking around in a chronic state of grief, and I needed to let the mourning and the grieving of the sadness of my life to come to end. And then when I hear the promises that she rolled off without even looking at a book, I say, and I don't even know that guy, is that every promise there that I would know a new life and a new peace of mind, I receive every one of them. Every single one of them. In everything of my past, and all the pain and all the shame, everything I ever did has been turned to, I have scars. And there's a lady called Liz Bailey. She taught me how to turn my scars into stars. And I stand before, and I will go to any state, anywhere, any place, any time. And I'm not a good speaker. I listen to Marcia, and I listen to their, I listen to them. They're so organized and so articulate. And I sit in wonder, and I could never. And I got to speak. I should have spent Friday night and got it over with. And you know what? I only have one message. And that, I think, is about letting go and letting God. And if I can get sober, anybody can. Because I had nothing to live for. I had nothing left. And getting back to my career, the cynic was no longer reading it when I found it that day. And I read the prayer and it said, thank you, God, for all that you have given me. A second chance at life. And thank you, God, for all that you have taken away. My guilt, my fears, my anger, it just could have gone on and on and on and on. What he has taken away. And thank you for what you have left me. And I realized the wondrous gift. And I used to think, did I have the right kind of a spiritual awakening? Did I get the guy? I know that I had spiritual experience. And many more. I had many, many. That was the big daddy of them all, the first one. Did I have the right kind that Bill was talking about as a result of taking my step? Yes. Because when I read that, and I read that prayer, the cynic read it first, and I was transformed and changed in 3 years. And I could read the same prayer with a new meaning, because a new woman was written. And I said, thank you, God, for what you have left me to live the rest of my life in peace. And let me tell you, you can take these steps and be finished. But unless you use them and reuse them, and they become a way of life, like you shift the car, it's just, that's it. These things that you found on your seats, these were a gift from me, from New York. Read it. Does everyone have one? because I don't want anybody not to go home. It says, "Dear God, I am powerless and my life is unmanageable without your help and guidance. I came today because I believe that you can restore and renew me to meet my needs today, whatever. Since I cannot manage my life or affairs, I have decided to give them to you. I put my life, my will, my thoughts, my desires and ambitions in your hands. I give you all of me, the good and the bad, the character defects, the shortcomings, my selfishness, resentments and problems. I know that you will work them out in accordance with your plan. Such as I am, take and use me in your service. Guide and direct my ways and show me what to do for you. I cannot control or change my friends or loved ones. So I release them into your care for your loving hands to do with as you will. Just keep me loving and free from judging them. If they need changing, God, you'll have to do it. I can't. Just make me willing and ready to be of service to you, to have my shortcomings removed and to do my best. Help me to see how I have harmed others and help me to be willing to make amends to them all and keep me ever mindful of thoughts and actions that harm myself and others, which separate me from your light, love, and spirit. And when I commit these errors, make me aware of them and help me to admit each one promptly. I am seeking to know you better, to love you more. I am seeking the knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry that out." That was written by a real alcoholic. That is not a religious prayer. That's from the home for the homeless alcoholic men in Greenland. And they thought it was so anointed that it bore printing and is made into a bookmark. And all I can say is read these slogans. Notice nuts, N-U-T-S. It means not using your steps. That's Renina. And I want to thank you once again. I'm afraid to look at the clock. But I did my best, and I had the spiritual covering, so I hope you heard them. Thank you.